We're talking about marathon running on Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin has dozens of marathons on the calendar this year, and the season continues tomorrow with the Milwaukee Marathon. It starts and ends at the Pfizer Forum with views of Lake Michigan waterfront, Lake Park, Marquette along the way. Do you plan on running any part of the upcoming marathons in Wisconsin? What's your training like? What are you looking forward to? What are you dreading? Or how do you motivate yourself? We're at 800-642-1234. Jenny Kemp is a physical therapist at UW Health Sports Rehabilitation Clinic, where she treats lower extremity injuries due to running in the runner's clinic. And she is a runner herself and an Ironman triathlete. Jenny, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
So right now, runners are out. They're out running, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Why is this such a popular form of exercise?
It's accessible. Anyone can go and run. You just need a pair of shoes and a safe neighborhood, and you can do it anywhere at a very low cost. So,
completing a marathon, though, is a whole nother deal. You know, that's really a feat. And you've completed one yourself. You've done an Ironman. Why did you decide to race?
Well, that's a good question. I think part of it is that personal achievement, to set a challenging goal and see if you can accomplish it. I think the other part is the training, the dedication and the hard work and the commitment. And then at the end, to look back and see what all you've done and to some extent what you've sacrificed, and then how much more meaning it has to you after completing it. Some people do it for overall health and wellness. And then some people truly love it. It makes them who they are.
It's really a journey, and it's an individual thing for every person. Are marathon runners, you know, simply just considered born to run marathons, or can they grow on you? Can you develop that affinity over time?
Oh, I think a lot of people develop it. There are certain people who are born truly to run, and they run fast and they run well. And fortunately, we don't ever see them in the clinic because they really don't get hurt either. That's the crazy part. And then other people, I think, start out with a classic 5K, 10K, and then, you know, they do that and they're like, well, Can I do the next level? Can I do the half marathon? And then the next one is the marathon. And so you certainly see people start out at a low level and then build up to the longer distances.
Yeah. And, you know, if you're contemplating that first marathon, where should you start to even attempt that goal?
I think the first one is to see how much you can run right now. Even if you're not running, there are a lot of programs that start you with a walk, run, and build up over time. In the area or wherever you live, there's a lot of opportunities to join a group that can help lead you there. And then the internet has a lot of running programs to help most people start. But I think the first step is, can you run a 5K and then develop from there?
And this lead up to a marathon may take months, perhaps years.
Correct. You know, I think the minimum is about 4 months or 16-week training programs. And that usually assumes that you've had some running
background.
Yes, correct.
Yeah. And, you know, when I talk to, you know, running moms, marathon moms, you know, they say, love the marathon. It's so great. But the thing is, it's all that training leading up to it. It's so much time. So how do you balance that out? Are there any tricks to the time it takes to prepare for a marathon?
I think part of it is having everyone in your life, you know, be on board and supportive. The nice thing about running is you can do it any time of day. I mean, there's headlamps, there's safety things that you can do to run early in the morning or late at night. It's also okay sometimes if you can't get a large chunk of running in to break it up throughout the day. A lot of people do two runs per day to build the volume. And, you know, weekends or days off tend to be most people's long runs.
And that those long runs, too, on the weekends, those 18-milers, that's going to take a chunk of time out of your weekend.
It takes a lot of time, yes. I mean, a minimum run is going to take anywhere between 2 and 3 hours. And so that's where you see a lot of people start early or start on a treadmill and then head outside. Again, it has to do with a little bit of a lifestyle change. But I think that's what, you know, kind of at the end makes everything so much more enjoyable. When you look back to how much time you've dedicated and you get to the event and you finish it, it's just that much more enjoyable.
We're talking with Jenny Kemp. She is a physical therapist at UW Health Sports Rehabilitation Clinic. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a running enthusiast? How often do you run? And if you're a marathoner, What is your favorite one to do in Wisconsin? What is your favorite one as a spectator? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Jenny, there are so many events out there. Mm-hmm. I was in awe of just how many marathons there are in Wisconsin. There are a lot. You could do one like every weekend.
Yes. Yes, that's correct.
So how do you decide whether you should do a 5K, a 10K, half marathon, or some other type of race?
Part of it is the distance that you want to go. I think a lot of it also is where you live. Some people like to travel. I've traveled for a lot of my half marathons to make an event out of it. Sometimes it may be just you can train on the course, and so then you enjoy staying local. It's more convenient. Also, your family can come and watch, and your friends can come and support. So I think it depends on what you enjoy. If you like traveling, it's a great – I mean, you pack your shoes and you head anywhere, or if it's just more convenient to stay local. In terms of the distance – I think people like to challenge themselves, but you also want to make sure that it's something that is within somewhat of your comfort zone.
So let's say you have signed up for a marathon and you need to put this plan in place. Should you just start going around the internet? How do you put your plan together for training?
The internet's probably the easiest location. There are a lot of very good free training programs that have you running anywhere between 4 and 5 times per week. Sometimes a friend will have trained previously and can help guide you. And then many local running groups do have programs that you train with a group, with the end result being the marathon or the half marathon. And so they'll help train you with 1 or 2 group runs per week and then 1 or 2 runs on your own during the week.
So that may help you stay motivated and committed, knowing that you have to turn out.
Yes. And it also builds the friendship and the social network. And that's why a lot of people also run is the only chance that they get to see that group of 4 friends every Sunday morning for their run.
They have running buddies.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And they really enjoy that. And that's sometimes when people get hurt. I think the big part that they miss is that social network that now they no longer get to see on a regular basis.
So in terms of getting hurt, you see lots of running issues at your clinic. What are some of the most common things out there?
In adults, knee pain is by far the most common injury. The literature tells us that about 80% of runners get injured annually, which that's a really high number. The knee is the most common, and then shin pain usually second.
Yeah. And so how do you start in physical therapy with knee pain, for instance?
That's a good question. So the way that we approach runners is there's 3 components that are going to give them an injury. It can be a musculoskeletal fault, like a muscle is too tight or too weak. It can be a running error. Sometimes the way that you run can cause more stress to your body. And then the 3rd component's a training error. Maybe you got overzealous, and instead of that 10K, you doubled it by accident on the weekend.
Oops.
And so we try to address one of those components, find which one is the primary cause and treat that.
Yeah. And then that treatment can perhaps take a while to get back on your feet.
It can. I try to not have anyone stop running unless they absolutely need to. I think it's helps them to stay motivated. It also helps us to continue to determine if they're getting better or not. And so you just want to have them run at a low enough level that's not causing more problems, but maybe they're not able to get to that highest training level that they want. But typically 6, 8, sometimes 10 weeks, depending on the injury, yeah.
We're talking about marathon running on Wisconsin Weekend ahead of the Milwaukee Marathon tomorrow. Physical therapist Jenny Kempf is our guide. She's with UW Health Sports Rehabilitation Clinic. Have you ever run a marathon? What challenges did you face while training? What did it feel like during the race? Did you complete the race? How did that feel? Join in with your experiences at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about marathons in Wisconsin on this edition of Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Milwaukee Marathon is tomorrow. It's one of the first Wisconsin marathons in the 2019 season, and it's one of dozens of Wisconsin marathons on the calendar this year, most of these endurance runs clustered in the month of September. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is running a marathon on your bucket list? Are you a seasoned marathoner? What are your tips for first-timers? You can call in, you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jenny Kemp stays with us. She is a physical therapist at UW Health Sports Rehabilitation Clinic, where she works in the runner's clinic specifically. Jenny, you know, once you get to that race day, you are filled with adrenaline. You've done all your training. You've been committed to it. What's a really good morning routine before hitting the pavement and really going out and running that race?
Yeah, I think staying consistent with what you've used in the past. Many times we recommend that what you plan on doing on race day, you try to do, you know, practice it maybe a couple weeks ahead of time just to see how the timing goes out, how your calories and nutrition works. I think the big thing is stay calm, know where you're going to go and what corral you're in, and just get there and just be ready to go.
There are all these little details like, where do I put my stuff?
Correct.
What do I do when I pick up my race bag? Where, you know, what wave am I in? Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of little nuances for first timers that can be kind of daunting.
Correct. And most races do a really good job with a participant guide where they'll send you information ahead of time. A lot of them allow you now to sign up for extra information and guidelines. I mean, I think attending the expo is helpful. You can see the course. You can get a feel for the atmosphere and where everything's going to start at. They do make it very user-friendly now, which I think is why so many people enjoy doing it, because it is designed for a positive event, and it's an event, too. And so they want to make sure everyone is having a good time and knows where to go.
And has a really, you know, good experience. And so with that mental state and your mentality as you cross the line, how do you, you know, what is it like when you do finish and where you go from there? Because you've had this really big high, mm-hmm. and now you're done with that high. And maybe you feel a little empty or something.
Right. There is a sense of, you know, many times you can fill the time with all the things that you maybe put on hold or tried to rearrange. But I think there is that sense of, what are you working towards? And so it's always nice, I think, to have something then on the back burner, almost a smaller distance race, just in case if you need to recover. It's nice in a couple of weeks to have a 5K or a 10K. I think the other interesting thing about these long events is you're going to go through some good times and some bad times, which I think we all forget at the finish line and even for the next 2 hours afterwards. And I think in those tough times during the race, having a little bit of a mantra that helps you kind of stay positive and keep moving forward can make the whole day even more positive to help you achieve your goal.
Let's go to Joy now, joining us from Chippewa Falls. Hi, Joy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call this morning.
Sure.
I was going to describe my experience running a half marathon as a middle-aged woman. There was a bunch of us that trained for about a year and a half for this big event. And we ran a trail run in Devil's Lake and the big ski hills. It was the most amazing thing ever. We were bouncing from rock to rock, climbing over trees. And I'm not a small person by any means. So if you really want to do this thing, you really can. It's pretty cool.
Oh, wow. Did that motivate you, Joy, to do other types of races like this, other half marathons?
Not half marathons, but 10Ks where they were trail runs, because that, for me, is just, you're out in the nature running in the woods. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so those trail runs give you a lot of, you know, a lot of joy to be able to go out there and run on terrain that might, you know, you never know what's coming up ahead of you.
Yeah, it was a rough race, the half marathon. You know, some people got hurt, unfortunately, not me, thank goodness. But it is something you really have to pay attention to. And like I said, I had some really good friends that we did this. It was something that we strive, you know, we have another goal to do another one coming up here.
Are you, Jenny, familiar with that race?
I am familiar, yes. And it's a beautiful park. And yes, trail runs really can add to the excitement. It tends to slow the race down, which for a lot of times means a faster recovery because you're not beating yourself up as much. And your foot strike is a little bit different each time. So that's great and fun to be outside and get energy from nature.
Thank you, Joy, for the call. Which brings us to shoes, because there's trail shoes, yes. There's the pavement shoes. What do we need to know about shoes?
First thing is comfort. Comfort. What we know from a lot of research that has been done is if you provide someone with three shoe options and they pick one based on comfort, they're over halfway there. They're like 60% of the way there. And so that's what I recommend to all of my clients is choose on comfort. And then the second component is what your foot looks like when you are running. And so sometimes you do need a specialist to help you out, especially if you're having some problems. They can help watch how you run and then kind of guide you with the comfort and then the shoe selection.
Oh, yeah, because if your feet roll inward, is it pronate?
That's pronate, yep, pronate, and roll out, routes, supinate.
Supinate, yep, mm-hmm. yep. So you put those shoes on and they feel great, mm-hmm. but then you go running and you get some blisters.
Correct. It's potentially, yeah, not the right shoe. You know, we can recommend changing the sock. Maybe the sock is a little bit too thick. Maybe you need a wider shoe or sometimes a longer shoe. Many times we recommend a half size larger than what you currently wear just because of how much the foot can move inside the shoe, which can cause blisters or even a toenail to kind of have some problems.
Hmm. And so it's okay to go bigger on running shoes?
Usually a half size.
Wow. Okay. So what about recovery and other types of training that can be a companion to your running? What about yoga? What about other things?
Great idea. And I strongly recommend it. I always tell people it's like your car. You got to keep doing all these things to have it keep moving forward. And so some kind of flexibility or mobility, whatever you tend towards. So yoga is great. Foam rolling is great.
Even foam rolling?
Yes, where you take a roll of foam and then you just roll along the major muscle groups. Mm-hmm. Anything that has a little bit of substance to it, you can roll on, even like a medicine ball or a soccer ball. They're very easy to come by, but that helps as a recovery is usually how you want to use it. So after you've run, after everything has tightened up a little bit, to use some stretching or foam rolling or yoga to help loosen all the tissue back up.
What about swimming?
I think cross training is a really nice way to not beat up the body as much, but to maintain fitness. That's a fantastic idea, as is cycling. We know that biking, especially some high intensity biking, carries over very well into running.
We had a listener who called in and said that she struggles with her leg muscles developing too quickly when she runs. Can that pose challenges?
Typically not. I mean, I guess if you're concerned about increased weight of running, that can potentially be an issue, but usually not cause any significant damage.
Okay. Lacey in Monona emailed us to ask about an experience she had with a cross-country coach. He told her, run with her arms low by your waist rather than holding them higher, and she never understood why.
I think that's a personal component. Many people think that the higher you hold your arms, you're wasting a little bit of energy if you're turning on more shoulder muscles to keep your arms at a 90-degree angle. That's also something that I think is a personal preference. So one thing we don't want people to do is put their arms too wide so that they're rotating too much. But whether it's at your waist or at your chest is usually more of a running technique and what you're comfortable with.
There was one other question about shoes, and they're on my mind. But when do you know your running shoes are worn out?
So typically we tell people 300 to 500 miles. But I always encourage people to look at the bottom of your shoe and see what it looks like side to side. Number one, they should look about the same in terms of where they're wearing down. And then number two, almost treat it like your car tire. Like if two little blocks are almost worn completely down to the base, you wouldn't typically drive on a tire like that, especially in Wisconsin. So then that's usually a good indicator if you need to switch out shoes as well.
Okay. So now we're at race day, lots of spectators. Mm-hmm. How much do runners need that type of support from spectators?
I think it helps a lot. I think it's a great component, especially if you know someone, putting them along the course. You kind of have that anticipation of, oh, I hope I get to see them. When do I get to see them? That, I think, is exciting. I also think many times on long races, when you have one of those little low points, to have someone just cheer you on or say something that maybe is funny or uplifting or silly, that just you know, for the next half mile or mile, you're kind of thinking about what they just said to you or how they encouraged you. And that can really help, I think, to get you through some of the tougher times. So I think the fan support is very important.
And for us spectators out there, what can we do to really encourage these runners that go by?
Well, being there, I think, is helpful. A lot of races have athlete trackers now, so that you can follow whoever you're tracking quite closely. And then the more that you see them, I think sometimes that surprises them. It's almost an event for you as a spectator to try and stay ahead of whoever you're tracking and cheering on. I mean, I think they have just as much fatigue after the race potentially as you do. But it is helpful and a great source of motivation and encouragement.
Have you ever thought of running another marathon?
Oh, maybe in an Ironman. I don't know if a standalone marathon. I would probably be one of the biggest users of our runner's clinic if I continue to run too much.
Well, Jenny, thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
Jenny Kempf is a physical therapist at the UW Health Sports Rehabilitation Clinic, where she specializes in treating injuries due to running or cycling. This is Wisconsin Weekend here on The Morning Show, and coming up, we tour Milwaukee's Skywalk system. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. News is next. It's Wisconsin Weekend on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, join us Tuesday at 1 for the annual State of the Tribes Address, streaming online at WPR.org. Oneida Chairman Tehasi Hill presents the address before a joint session of the legislature live from the state capitol. That's the State of the Tribes Address, Tuesday at 1, streaming online at WPR.org. Now we're on a tour of skywalks in Milwaukee on Wisconsin Weekend. We're on a jaunt through Milwaukee's 9 skywalks, or their skyways. That's the word I grew up with in Minneapolis. Whatever you call them, they connect buildings across 8 city blocks in downtown Milwaukee. Do you work in downtown Milwaukee and use the skywalks to get from place to place in the winter? What do you love about taking them? What do you notice about the flow of people through them? I like to look at the people in skywalks. We're at 800-642-1234. Julia Griffith is the program director at Historic Milwaukee. The organization offers a 2-hour skywalkie tour. Julia, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much.
Well, so to start this tour, how many miles of skywalks do we have in Milwaukee? What is the setup?
Mm-hmm. It's right about a mile and a half. And obviously there's some building in between the skywalks. But in total, yeah, it's about a mile and a half.
And so how does that compare to other Midwestern cities? I mean, I remember lots of skyways in Minneapolis.
Yeah, so it's a fair bit smaller than Minneapolis, but they also strategically planned their skywalk system as a system and to be larger than the one that happened in Milwaukee. It was far more piecemeal. They kind of came about in sections, working out from Grand Avenue Mall and then up towards the convention center.
Oh, so they were kind of add-on to the buildings as an afterthought.
Yeah, more sort of strategic movement tools than something kind of in somebody's like larger scheme.
Has there ever been any impetus to make Milwaukee's skywalk system bigger?
Yes and no. So for a while in the 80s, when they were most popular, the system kind of grew. And then Mayor Norquist and some other politicians thought that they were taking away from street level commerce, which is one argument against them. And so they sort of fell out of favor. And now you see them more in smaller complexes. So they just added one between the Pfizer Forum and the parking ramp. And there's a few in the Northwestern Mutual Complex. But a sort of larger overhaul or a bigger system, not to my knowledge. There's never really been more recent discussion to make it larger.
Help us understand the motivation to build these for pedestrians. Is it specifically for the cold?
Or inclement weather in general. There were clearly amenities, particularly in the Grand Avenue Mall in its heyday, that particularly employers wanted to get their employees to. And I think in the sense of, will I go outside or shop if the weather is bad? No, but I'll take a small, you know, kind of floating skywalk. Yes. It was something kind of mutually beneficial to all. And so it sort of started with just a few points from the old Federal Building to the Grand Avenue Mall, then kind of on the Boston Store corner, and then also from the Chase Bank Building across the river. So, and then grew from there, but really was about essentially feeding people. It's easy to leave a lunch hour in the middle of winter if you can get somewhere and not really need a coat.
Have skywalks always been these really glass-like structures, lots of visibility out to the street?
Yeah, I think primarily because, particularly in Milwaukee, people were really concerned in some places about blocking views. The one that crosses Water Street, looking towards City Hall, they were worried that it would block that beautiful view up water. So that one in particular was built with a lot of glass. But I think in general, they are sort of capturing great vistas as it is that you maybe wouldn't necessarily see otherwise, particularly given they're at least on the second floor of a building. So adding all that glass made them kind of attractive. Certainly maybe doesn't make them the most energy efficient, but definitely makes them places to stop and get a great view of Milwaukee.
Yeah, and they're so airy, and you feel like you're just suspended a little bit in this right above traffic. Julia Griffith is our guide. She's program director at Historic Milwaukee, talking about Milwaukee's skywalk system. Do you like the skywalks? Why or why not? Do you think they're a great place to see the city, or perhaps you think they obstruct views? Let us know at 800-642-1234. Perhaps you've taken the Skywalkie tour. Call in, tell us about it. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Julia, your Skywalkie tour is very popular. Does it cover all the skywalks in Milwaukee?
It can. So we have a set of kind of elongated script, and each guide is able to spend as much or as little time in a particular place as they might like. So each Skywalkie tour is a little bit different. It's all got great, well-researched information, but touches on some different points. So yeah, you can see them all. You just might have to take the tour a couple of times.
And you could be walking for a while. Some of these, your tours are 2 hours.
Yeah, so we cover a fair amount of ground, and we actually exceed the skywalks 1.5 miles. It's a little bit closer to almost two, just because there's a little bit of extra walking and some backtracking, because you gotta, you know, go to the one end and then back. But so calculated, it's about 1.75 miles. So,
why do you think this tour is so popular? Why do people gravitate to it?
I think it's for a couple of reasons. We only offer it in the colder months. So I think, I mean, having lived in Wisconsin most of my life, winter cabin fever is a real thing. But my favorite part of the skywalks, and one of the reasons I think architecture nerds really like them, is because you get right up close to architectural ornament and the exterior facade of a building in a way that at the ground level you may not. You can really kind of see some of the detail. I'm thinking the ASQ Center right off of Wisconsin Avenue has some beautiful glazed terracotta, which ornament, which from the street is a little bit harder to see, but you can get right up close and kind of look at that craftsmanship and really appreciate it in a way you don't from the street.
And do we know some details about how that craftsmanship came to be, came to life?
Yeah, so that was actually Gimbel's department store. And in the tour, we talk about the architects, how buildings have changed over time, and things like architectural terracotta, which is actually pretty prominent in Milwaukee. You see a lot of it, but from the street, you may not know it's terracotta. So it's kind of fun to show people things they maybe see every day, but don't really know what they are.
Why does Milwaukee have more than usual, or was that just a trend among a cluster of architects there?
Just a trend. And I think we have, what we do have is maybe not more than other places, but certainly collected kind of nicely into downtown buildings. It's a pretty common architectural material, but the glazed version on something like the ASQ Center, where it's so much of it, isn't necessarily very normal. It's also pretty temperamental, and the winter months can be pretty harsh on terracotta. So having so much on one facade is kind of a feat of defeating the elements, basically. So it's lovely to see how much has really survived in a place where freezing and thawing occurs, and that can be really harmful to terracotta.
What are your favorite questions that come up on these tours?
Oh, that's a good question. Probably I enjoy when people see things that they have never really taken time to look at. If you're on the skywalk looking down Wisconsin Avenue towards Marquette, there's a building with a mural painted on the side. Richard Haas did it in 1981, and it looks like a building. It looks like an Art Deco building, but it's a mural. And we've had people who are like, well, why is that building so flat? And I'm like, it's a mural. And they have told me, I've driven past that building every day of my life, and I never realized it wasn't finished on that side. So sometimes it's not necessarily a question, but it's more just kind of exposing people to slow down a little bit and kind of showing them things that in their car they maybe wouldn't notice.
Right. They have a different perspective, and
exactly.
And they even at a different level, too. So there are some fascinating bits of history on this tour, like the attempted assassination of Teddy Roosevelt. Can you tell us that?
Yeah. So Teddy Roosevelt was on his way, actually, to give a speech in Milwaukee, right near the little parking lot next to the Hyatt, which has the giant rotating restaurant on top, which people probably remember. And he was shot. Luckily, his extensive speech was folded multiple times in his breast pocket. It stopped the bullet enough not to kill him. The bullet actually did penetrate his body, but he sort of soldiered on, gave the speech, and then received medical attention. But yeah, luckily he had it in his pocket. So they'll show you where that happened and kind of talk you through the dramatic event.
And what about Gertie the Duck and her ducklings?
Yeah, so Gertie the Duck, forever immortalized in bronze on the Wisconsin Avenue Bridge, was a real-life duck who laid her eggs on a bridge piling. So basically a giant tree trunk sunken into the ground, which supported the bridge on Wisconsin Avenue in the waning days of World War II. And the city basically rallied around her. It's a really sort of tenuous place to have a nest full of eggs. But they decided that she was going to successfully hatch them. So she was tended. When the ducklings got too big to all be on the piling, they were moved to the Gimbel's department store window on the corner, where they were tended to by a registered nurse. And when they were finally old enough, they were all released into Juneau Park. So if you see mallard ducks in Juneau Park, they could be Gertie's ancestors.
We are taking a tour of Skywalks in downtown Milwaukee with Julia Griffith as our guide. She's from the organization Historic Milwaukee. You can join in 800-642-1234. Do you walk the Skywalks for exercise, perhaps as part of getting to work? Do you walk them to see Milwaukee in a new light? What do you think of this system? You can call in at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're exploring Milwaukee Skywalk system on this edition of Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Most of Milwaukee's skywalks were built in the 80s, and in the 1990s, a committee was created to review the design of future skywalks, and the city's newest skywalk connects Pfizer Forum with a parking garage. Do you have a favorite Milwaukee skywalk, or do you know of a skywalk with a great view? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Julia Griffith is our tour guide this morning with the organization Historic Milwaukee. Julia, my favorite skywalk in Milwaukee is the one that connects our Milwaukee Bureau in the Federal Building, which used to connect us to the Boston store, and going across to the, and I can't think of the downtown mall there. But what's the deal with that skywalk? Because I think it's closed now.
Temporarily, yeah. So you're talking about the bright blue one,
yep,
which matches the Federal Building. Yeah, so it's temporarily closed while they do some renovations on the Boston store side or old Boston store side, and actually in the 311 building as well. So only temporary. Rest assured, I've been told by many people that it'll be back.
So do you need to change your tour at all for these various things that come up, whether it's construction or something else?
Yeah, so we're really obviously excited about the Grand Avenue Mall and all of the changes that are happening, but it has meant a little bit of refiguring. So luckily, I work with a great group of volunteer guides who are flexible. So there's a little point. It used to be 100% inside, and now there's just you cross Wisconsin Avenue. But luckily, through our program, Doors Open, we have a lot of great contacts of building managers who are happy to let us knock on the door on the weekends and let us in.
Where can people go to get more information about the Skywalkee tours?
Yeah, so they can find information about the Skywalkee tours as well as all of our summer walking tours at historicmilwaukee.org. We also have a Facebook page. It's at Historic Milwaukee, and we're pretty easy to find.
So I understand these Skywalkee tours, they are seasonal, and the season is ending soon?
Yeah, so we only have them through the end of April, but then we actually offer exterior walking tours. Historic Milwaukee was founded in the 70s. To give walking tours. We're the only nonprofit in Milwaukee that gives this kind of historic architectural walking tour. So we do downtown, the Riverwalk, North Point Mansions, Bayview, Brady Street. We kind of bounce all around during the summer months. So we have a tour at least one every day.
And are these tours all different lengths?
Yeah, they're all about the same amount of time, an hour and a half to 2 hours, but vary in walking lengths. But that being said, they cover residential and commercial architecture. We talk about houses of worship, kind of unique features on the landscape, and also how we got to the city that we have today, how neighborhoods came to be, how Milwaukee's downtown was created. So we go all the way back, even before there were buildings on the landscape.
Do you think we learn more on foot as we understand the history of Milwaukee?
I think to a certain extent, yes. You really get to slow down and sort of look around in a way that's safe because you're not operating a motorized vehicle. But you also, I think, notice things, text. There's so much text on buildings that people don't notice, iconography, things like that. You're never going to see when you're just in your car or on the bus. So I think having the opportunity with a sort of seasoned guide who can easily point out the things you may not see, you actually can train yourself to notice them in other cities you visit, in your own neighborhood, basically wherever you go.
Well, with spring, summer around the corner, what is your favorite walking tour of the upcoming season?
Oh, that's a great question. I think my favorite right now is the Riverwalk. I think I've lived in a few cities that didn't really appreciate their water as much as I've noticed Milwaukeeans are starting to. And it's a fascinating, the Riverwalk itself along the Milwaukee River is a fascinating infrastructure project. There's public-private partnerships. There's a lot of adaptive reuse. So many historic buildings have been given new life. And it's just a great evening tour that we have on Wednesdays. You really can't beat it.
Well, Julia, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, it was fun.
Julia Griffith is the program director at Historic Milwaukee. We've been talking about their Skywalkee tour and the upcoming tours for summer. And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's a piece from Madison comedian Esteban Tuma about what he calls the competitive sport of Wisconsin small talk.
Now that we've hopefully moved on from winter, Madison comedian Esteban Tuma is taking time to reflect on cold weather in Wisconsin. Born and raised in Ecuador, the state's severe winters have tested him. But an even greater challenge for Tuma has been acclimating to how much Wisconsinites like to talk about the weather.
As I step out of the deep freeze and unwrap 6 layers of winter gear in the lobby, I see Wendy from HR approaching. It's on. I'm trapped. It's time for small talk. Am I scared? Of course. This is not your average banter. This is Wisconsin small talk. And I'm facing Wendy herself, the queen of chit-chat. She's in the big leagues. As she approaches with the warmest smile, I start to sweat. This is not amateur hour.
Esteban!
She shouts, eyes sparkling.
I almost didn't make it. I have no idea why I even got out of bed today,
she says, pointing at the blizzard outside. This is why she's a legend, not even a...
Hey!
No sign of a...
Oh, how are you?
The worst thing about Wisconsin's winter is not that it sucks. It does. It's that you're forced to talk about it. A lot. But I don't even flinch. I've been training. Big smile, hands on hips, strong eye contact. The only thing that got me out of bed, I say, skipping a beat for maximum effect, was coffee. She bursts into laughter. Oh, how we chuckle and howl. Maybe Wendy from HR has finally met her match. When I arrived in Madison 6 years ago, I was unprepared. When animals meet, they growl, display their plumage, or sniff butts. Small talk in Wisconsin seemed like a similar show of dominance, and I wanted no part of it. As an immigrant from South America, I tried hard to avoid it, arriving late to all meetings, speaking Espanol to my Uber driver, or keeping it under 12 items so I could use the self-checkout machine at the grocery store. As Wendy and I move slowly down the hall, I feel like I'm doing great. She talks about the unpredictability of March, I mention Al Gore, and we share a moment of silence for the polar bears.
Aww.
I wonder to myself why Wisconsinites are so keen on this. There's no need for small talk where I'm from. Quito, Ecuador is a pretty big cosmopolitan city where we kiss hello with strangers, quickly compliment each other, and go on our way. Our social connections involve salsa music, Catholicism, and all those germs from smooching strangers. When Wendy and I reach the end of the hallway, I realize we're going in opposite directions, but we linger. Too much is on the line, and I will not go gently into that.
Have a good day!
But I must confess, compared to the frozen gray outside, Wendy's casual banter is making me feel warm inside, and I start to understand. I imagine early settlers who, after setting up and getting comfortable during the Wisconsin summer, endured their first winter weather. What stopped them from packing up and heading south? Maybe someone rolled their eyes mid-blizzard and joked, "Nice day out there, huh?" And the extended chatter that followed lasted until it was time to collect berries, split logs, go fishing, and run from bears or whatever. Wendy helped me understand that. Sure, the weather sucks, but that's a small price to pay for the ability to connect with your neighbors about how much it sucks. As far as who won our small talk showdown, neither of us gave it up. So after 42 minutes and 2 follow-up emails, we decided we are getting married! We're looking at dates for next summer, or as we here in Wisconsin like to call it, road construction season.
Esteban Tuma is a comedian in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And Wisconsin Life is part of our weekly edition of Wisconsin Weekend here on The Morning Show. What's happening in your part of the state? Send us your ideas to mornings@wpr.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.